Yes, Your Honor.
So without further ado, we could start with Mr. Olson's argument, please. The case is set for 15 minutes per side. So Mr. Olson, if you want to make a rebuttal argument, please try to stop before the whole 15 minutes is used up. But if you're in a jam on time and you need an extra minute or two, I would grant that. We're not going to have time for much more than an extra minute or two. Okay, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Per Olson. I am counsel for the defendant and appellant, Ronald Thrasher. Given the time crunch, you know, I think I can make the points I want to make. I think the issues are pretty well briefed in the briefs, and I want to give an opportunity for the court to ask any questions that it has about my position on these matters. The main issue I'd like to discuss. First of all, are you hearing me okay?
Yes.
Very sure.
Okay, thank you. The main issue I'd like to discuss is the trial court's denial of a Franks hearing in this case. Now, the Franks case requires that the defendant make a substantial preliminary showing of material, reckless, or intentional false statements, or material and reckless or intentional omissions before being entitled to an evidentiary hearing. Substantial showing does not mean that it's my burden at this point to prove the falsity of the statements or the recklessness of omissions or false statements. Rather, it's just a threshold matter of determining, is there enough there allow me to get to the next stage of being able to question these officers who were involved in putting together this search warrant affidavit. Now, we believe that we made that showing in two respects, and the issues sort of got filtered down a little bit by the time we got to oral argument before Judge McShane. But the two key issues that we believe were entitled us to a Franks hearing had to do with whether the search warrant affidavit accurately described this phone call, this critical phone call between the informant and the defendant, as being a unambiguous call relating to set up a drug transaction. So that's one issue. And then the other issue had to do with the description in the search warrant affidavit regarding the informant's past history and her reliability as an informant. That part was in the affidavit in order to sort of bolster her credibility and veracity. And so those were the two main issues that we were challenging the affidavit on. Now, the description of the phone call.
May I ask you a question regarding the first item you listed? You said that the description of the phone call had to characterize it as unambiguously calling for a drug transaction. So what case says that the call must be unambiguously suggesting a drug transaction?
No, there is no such case, Your Honor. My point was that the affidavit described it as being unambiguous. My point isn't that it has to be unambiguous. My point was that the affidavit kind of falsely portrayed it as being unambiguous and leaving really no question that this was a drug-related call, and therefore really no question for the magistrate to decide that this was probable cause.
So is it your position that the word unambiguous should have been removed?
Well, it's not in the word unambiguous is not in the affidavit.
Okay.
My point is that the actual phone call, as described by Detective Wall in his report, was ambiguous, and therefore if that phone call is going to be used as probable cause, then the detective or whoever's authoring this search warrant affidavit has to describe it accurately, you know, how it actually, the phone call as it actually occurred, and then provide some more information about why the officer or the affiant thinks
counsel, what case are you relying upon to say that a drug transaction that's arranged for in coded language has to be further explained. What case says that?
Well, Your Honor, there's I don't know if there's a specific case that says that, but the overarching principle that I'm trying to put forward here is that they can't misconstrue, they can't mischaracterize a phone call in a search warrant.
Well, and what so, was specifically in the wording that the judge read? What specifically in the affidavit that was presented to the judge was misleading regarding the phone call?
So the affidavit reads, during the phone call, during the phone conversation, Thrasher agreed to sell CRI methamphetamine and arranged to meet CRI to purchase the methamphetamine. This conversation corroborated the CRI's drug purchasing relationship with Ronald Wayne Thrasher. So it's just that single sentence where it's describing it as an arrangement to meet to purchase methamphetamine, whereas...
What should it have said then, counsel?
It should have said, Your Honor, it should have said that that the informant talked to Mr. Thrasher and said that she wanted to meet him and wanted to see if they could meet up, because this is how it's described in Detective Wall's report. And Thrasher advised that he was driving from Prineville towards Madras and was almost there, and they would meet up. That's the essence of the phone call as it's described in Detective Wall's report. It doesn't say anything about methamphetamine. There's no code word for methamphetamine used in Detective Wall's recitation of the phone call. If there's any code in there, it was this phrase, meet, let's meet up, or let's get together, come see me, which is not typically what we would regard as code in the sense of these types of drug-related conversations. For example, they were talking about methamphetamine, you might expect to see windows or ice or, you know, some of these commonly used code words. To the extent there was a code word used, the CRI explained to Detective Wall that this is how she would order drugs. This is what she would say, let's meet up, or can I come see you? But she's the only one that provides that interpretation. She's the only one who says, this is what that phone call means. So it's not a situation where an officer is reasonably using his expertise to decide what code means, what sort of code drug dealers use, and then relaying that to the magistrate and allowing the magistrate to make the decision. It's a situation where the informant herself is saying, this is what this means. And so, which is problematic, Your Honor, because the whole point of this exercise, the whole point of having her place this phone call is to corroborate her veracity, their story of what she's saying about Mr. Thrasher being her drug supplier. And therefore, they could not just simply rely on her to explain to them what she meant by let's meet up. And so really the problem with this is that, you know, what they should have done then is describe it exactly as how it is set out in Detective Wall's report, so that the magistrate can make his own determination. And it was a male magistrate, that's why I say that, but make his own determination as to whether this phone call was sufficient. And instead, what the affiant did is just remove that. He usurped that role by saying, we're going to decide for you. This was a call regarding methamphetamine transaction, and that's all there is to it. So that's the main issue with regard to that part of the affidavit. And then the other part of the affidavit that we have a problem with is the part where there's a description of her past reliability. Now, the thing about this particular informant is that she had previously been an informant for this very same agency that was now investigating her again and Mr. Thrasher. They had a file on her. They knew there was a readily available source of information regarding her past reliability. And we believe that that description of her reliability was deficient because it talked about the positives, but it didn't talk about the negatives. And there were a lot of negatives that we readily found during the course of our own investigation as we were preparing for this motion regarding this informant and her past work for this very same agency. She had created some positive results for them. But there were, at the end of the day, she was no longer working for them because she was not reliable. And no one specifically said that, but I think we were entitled to an evidentiary hearing so we could question these the folks that had handled her before, and question them about, you know, what they knew about her and whether they really thought she was all that reliable. And so again, it's a threshold question of getting to, you know, our task today and our task before Judge McShane at the time of this oral argument was not to prove that these were false statements, but that there was enough there, that we showed to entitle us to at least get to the next stage of being able to question these detectives about these matters, about why they wrote the affidavit the way they did, about what they really knew and what they should have known about this.
Counsel, yes. I can interject for a minute. I understand the first point you were making, but on the second point, I'm a bit in the dark because I thought the affidavit did make clear that she was like a lower-level criminal, like a drug dealer, that she was involved in identity theft and other criminal matters. So what is it that what's the information that was left out that the magistrate needed to have on that point that wasn't provided?
There was some specific things about her past regarding, like towards the end of her work as an informant, she got caught with some methamphetamine once and specifically said, lied to a police officer about being currently on a code operation when she in fact was not. And so there was like a specific lie that she told to an officer in order to sort of get out of that little bit of a jam that she had. And there was also her criminal history was set forth there, but not all of it was set forth there. And there was also a case of a gentleman that she assisted in his arrest, a person by the name of Lewis Curtis, whose case sort of somewhat mysteriously was dismissed, and no one seems to know why. But I think we at least have some suspicion that she was determined to be unreliable. At least that's a reasonable assumption.
Thanks, counsel. I think you answered my question.
All right. So just to sum up here, again, the way this was, really the concern here is how the affiant working together with the other agents under the sort of the collective knowledge doctrine served up probable cause here on a silver platter to the magistrate. You know, there's no question if you just read the affidavit, it establishes probable cause. But I think they cut some corners in how they made some of their own conclusions about the nature of this phone call and how reliable this informant was. Whereas what they really should have done is just laid out the facts, laid out the true state of the facts in a neutral manner, and provide an opinion about probable cause, but leave it to the magistrate to decide that. And that's not what happened here. And so we would request that on this matter, that the matter be remanded back to the trial court for a Franks hearing. I'll reserve my remaining time.
Thank you, counsel. And now we'll hear from Ms. Potter.
Thank you. May it please the court, Amy Potter on behalf of the United States. There's no reason to remand this case to the district court because the district court looked at both prongs of the Franks test and determined not only were there no intentional misrepresentations or omissions, but that even if there were, they weren't material. Specifically with respect to the informant, in Judge McShane's 12-page order, and this is at ER 17, Judge McShane took every paragraph of the warrant and added in all the omissions that the defendant alleged were made. He added them in and reached the conclusion that there was still probable cause in the affidavit. He also looked carefully at the informant issue. He had over 500 pages from the defense detailing every criminal act she committed that they could find, from the theft of an MP3 player and an iPod to the identity theft conviction. And he made a finding that the detectives had done what they needed to do and proved up and corroborated those stories. The fact that the officers corroborated many of her statements compensated for general unreliability. And that's Judge McShane's finding at ER 24. And that's not clearly erroneous. Turning to the call, Judge McShane looked at the wall report. The wall report not only said what the call specifically contained, the meetup, but detailed that they were told it would be in code and that this was common in their training experience. Judge McShane looked at that and concluded that the summary in the affidavit was reasonable. That also is not clearly erroneous. Nor is Judge McShane's conclusion that the warrant had probable cause. So Judge McShane properly denied the Franks hearing on that basis. He made both findings. Going back to question the officers isn't going to change Judge McShane's materiality finding, because he's done the work, he did what the Franks hearing requires, and he added in the omissions and found there was probable cause. There are two other issues. I know defense counsel didn't address them. I'm happy to address them. It has to do with the search of the vehicle and the service of the cell phone tracking warrants. If the court has no questions, I can rest on my briefs. All right, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
I was just going to say, I have no questions. I see none from my colleagues. So, Mr. Olson, you could do rebuttal.
And Mr. Olson,
Your Honor,
if you would please address the second prong of the Franks test, the materiality.
Your Honor, just on the materiality, like, for example, with this phone call, if the court were to conclude that this the description of the phone call in the search warrant affidavit is false, and it was made false intentionally or recklessly, then the remedy would be to strike that sentence altogether. And so that takes out the description of the phone call altogether. And that's how, did I lose you?
Did Judge McShane do that analysis?
I don't think that's how he did it. No, he didn't. With respect to the phone call, he didn't say that the phone call was, I don't believe he reached the materiality decision with respect to the phone call. With the phone call, he said that he looked at the wall report and concluded that from the wall report, because it had information in there about how the informant described this phone call and said it was in code, he said that from that report, therefore, he cannot conclude that the affiant was intentionally misleading or reckless with respect to the truth. I don't believe he reached a materiality conclusion with respect to the phone call. And if he had, the remedy would have been not correcting, inserting in the accurate description, it would have been striking that sentence altogether from the affidavit.
What's your best case that says that if that sentence was inaccurate, the remedy is to strike the sentence rather than correct the inaccuracy?
Your Honor, I believe that's right in Franks. I believe that's straight out of the Franks decision. And if Franks doesn't say that, I'm sorry, I don't have another case right here, but I believe that any number of the cases that follow from Franks establish that. You can't be, and the reason for that is that, you can't insert something. That violates the four corners rule. So if you strike something, you can't put something in that the government, you know, they can't, you can't give the government an opportunity to correct it by adding something that was not there in the first place.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That's all I have. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank both council for their advocacy. It's a big help to the panel and the Thrasher case shall now be submitted, and the parties will hear from us in due course.